You're listening to Tony Talks Tikkun with Tony Ruma.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm not Tony Ruma. My name's Dr. Jonathan Moch. I'm standing in for Tony, who's away apparently in London. What I would like to speak about in this hour is what I think is a great Tikkun Olam, a correction in the world, and perhaps a thought experiment would be, is that if I'm in an elevator, the basement of, let's say, the Bill Gates Foundation, and I get into the lift, and there is Bill Gates, and he says, I'll give you $1 billion if you can tell me what can correct the world. And I would say without a doubt that it's mindfulness meditation. And that's what I want to speak about, is mindfulness meditation. And I welcome your participation via SMS. That's 34519, or you can phone 074-654-7335, and we might have a very interesting discussion. So why would I choose mindfulness meditation? Mindfulness meditation is basically becoming more aware of where you are in the present. I'll repeat that. Mindfulness meditation is the practice of intentionally keeping your attention on what is happening right now. That is what mindfulness meditation is all about. Mindfulness meditation is not an Eastern kind of practice, although it might originate in the East. But today, mindfulness meditation is mainstream and is recognized by many medical aid and insurance systems that it is an effective treatment for many disorders, not only psychological, such as depression or anxiety or low self-esteem, but also physical, such as arthritis and immune system problems. It certainly brings down the blood pressure and the heart rate. So it's a very exciting time to be involved in this project of mindfulness meditation, and more specifically about learning mindfulness practices. Mindfulness practices. That's what it's all about. It's very difficult to do, although it sounds quite simple, just to bring your attention to what is happening right now. Because we have enormous parts of our mind that likes to be distracted. That is the number one enemy, I think, that in today's world, that there's more and more distraction away from paying attention to what is happening now in the present. In South Africa, we talk a lot about state capture at present. It's front page news almost every day, and it's not something new to this country, or it's new to the world, but state capture is taking over key government departments and influencing policy, and that leads to corruption. What I think is perhaps even bigger is that thinking has actually captured the mind. Overthinking, believe it or not, is a capture of the mind. And that doesn't leave much space for being present on how you feel, what you see, what you hear, what you smell, what you taste, how your body feels, where it is in space. And so this thinking is overused and occupies most of what we call working memory, and what we're conscious about, and doesn't leave much space for what's else going on in this moment. Mindfulness isn't, we can do it. Mindfulness is not something that you need a medical aid, benefit, or get a script for, or pay for it, or you have to go to India or any mountains or forest. Mindfulness is just a breath away. Listen to that carefully. Mindfulness is just a breath away. Most of mindfulness practices begin by concentrating on the breath. When I was a medical student, I had the privilege over a few years to deliver approximately 240 babies. That was both in Johannesburg and Northern KwaZulu-Natal, where I spent most of my student holidays. Most of those babies, when they were born, were welcomed into the world by a little clap, a little smack on their rear end, and within a second, that baby started to cry. If the baby didn't cry, then we had problems. Of course, we smacked the baby not because we're cruel, but that was to get the lung function going. In other words, the breath is now fully developed. On the other side of the life cycle, I had the great misfortune on a few times, not 240, I would say maybe 30 or 40, where I was called into the hospital to pronounce that a patient had passed away and sign the documents. The hospitals I worked required that a doctor come and do that sad procedure. And of course, the first thing we look for is the breath. If there's a breath, obviously that person's still alive. If there's no breath, it's most likely that person has passed away. Now, from the moment we're born to the time we die, we are always breathing. Believe it or not, we breathe when we're fast asleep, we breathe when we're eating, we breathe when we're doing whatever. I worked out once that if you have, let's say, a breath cycle that lasts 3 seconds, that's 20 per minute, which is about 1,200 per hour. So if you're listening mindfully to this program for about an hour, you're going to breathe a full cycle of an in-breath and an out-breath about 1,000 to 1,200 times. And if you live to 70 years, I worked out, if my calculator is correct, it's about 24 million times that you breathe in and you breathe out. When was the last time that you paid full attention to your breath? Your breath is an anchor. Your breath is what is central to mindfulness practice. That is where we start mindfully watching the breath. But what I want to do, if you want to do this, and I would suggest if you're in the car, you shouldn't actually practice it, but if you're in your home and you're sitting, it's just to sit quietly, maybe close your eyes or keep your eyes open, and just watch your breath as you breathe in and out at the chest or in the abdomen or the nose or the mouth. And if you find it boring, which most people who are mindless, in other words, their thinking is controlling them, then they find it, well, what's the point of this? Well, if you find the breath boring, what I would suggest, certainly not if you're in a car, but close your mouth and then with your thumb and your finger, your forefinger, close both nostrils. And I guarantee you within a few seconds, your breath becomes very interesting. I wouldn't suggest you put your head under water, but also if you swim, you can only stay under water for a few seconds where you need to come out and breathe. So mindfulness, if we get back to the core point, is where you are right now. Are you present or are you caught up in your thinking? Most of our thinking, when you come to watch it and observe it, is about your past or about your future. If you watch your thinking, which you can do in mindfulness, training and practices, you'll notice that most of them are memories of what happened, what should have happened, what could have happened, what if, this or that. Then in the future, where the other thoughts are, is about anticipation or planning or whatever is coming up in the near or the far future. Doesn't leave much, as I said before, for being in the moment. So let's just sum up this introduction. Tikkun Olam, I've got $1 million that I can get from Bill Gates. And my clear argument in about 60 seconds is that if we could train every person in the world to be more mindful, to bring mindfulness into their daily life, we would have far less disease, would have far less anger, would have far less wars. It's time to have a short ad break.
From talk to music, from Johannesburg to Israel, from sport to business, this is 101.9 High FM.
Welcome back. My name is Dr. Jonathan Moch. I'm standing in for Tony Rumer, Tikkun Olam. I'm discussing this wonderful, wonderful practice mindset that you can develop, which is being mindful, which is bringing awareness into the present moment wherever you are. It's natural. You can do it. If you are listening to me for a few moments at least, you are showing mindfulness. But I'm sure if you followed where your thoughts are for the last minute and the next minute, you'll find them all over the show. Because the mind has a mind of its own. Jon Kabat-Zinn, a Jewish man, he's now in his early 70s, he brought mindfulness meditation into mainstream medicine, which is also now in Fortune 100 and Fortune 500 companies, in the military, in schools, in prisons. It's all over if people want to do it. It's not just for an illness. Mindfulness is really about awareness. Awareness and recognition of where you are right now. I spoke to a rabbi yesterday morning, Rabbi Koblenz, and I spoke to him about what is the Hebrew word for awareness. And he said Hakara. And Hakara, and he also gave me a source in the book of Jeremiah. I think it's chapter 8, verse 6, something like that, that the prophet says to the people, you don't listen, and you just go into life like a horse goes into war. I thought that was quite profound, that even Jeremiah, over 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years perhaps, was recognized that most human beings are actually mindless. They're not mindful. Mindful is where awareness of where you are and recognizing where you are right now without judgment. And that's a critical thing that Jon Kabat-Zinn, who started the first really good stress reduction clinic in Boston, Massachusetts, says, that mindfulness is paying attention in the moment with intention, non-judgmentally. In other words, you're not saying this is good or bad, this is relaxing or stressful. It's just becoming aware, creating a distance in your mind between what's going on in your mind. This is an interesting concept, that thinking, overthinking, fills the mind space. It's like if you put stones into a pot, soon that pot will fill up and there's not much room for other stones. This is what thinking does. Thinking about the past, the present, what you have to do, what you should have done, over and over, causes the mind to overflow. When you start practicing awareness, a remarkable thing happens. You start to create space between you and your thoughts. And when you start to do that, then you start to recognize your emotions. You start to recognize the birds singing. You start to recognize the air flowing across your face. You start to taste the chicken. You start to smell the soup. Suddenly your brain now has more space for what's going on right now. And that's what awareness and mindful training is all about. If we go back to the original, let's say, Hebrew word for recognition is hakir. Hakir, which is to recognize now. There's two beautiful passages, very difficult in fact, full of violence in a way, in the Chumash. The first is between Yehuda and his brothers when they're showing that famous coat, that multicolored coat that Jacob gave to Yosef, Joseph. And the story, as many people know, the brothers sold Joseph and he went off to Egypt. And they tried to tell the father that the coat they found and had blood. And this was a wild animal who had torn Yosef apart, and that was the reason why he was missing. And Yehuda says to Yaakov, his father, Hakir na, please recognize. And when Yaakov, the father, recognized that, he tore his clothes and he actually sat in mourning for almost 22 years. The second one was between Tamar and Yehuda, that same Yehuda. And Tamar, her first two husbands, who were the actual sons of Yehuda, had died. And the third one, she should have married, but Yehuda was holding off because he was scared that he would die as well. So Tamar clothes herself as a prostitute, as a harlot, and then entices Yehuda, and she falls pregnant. There's, of course, a big tumult in the little village, and Yehuda, who's like head of it, says that Tamar must be put to death because she committed adultery. Then Tamar sends a message to Yehuda and says, do you recognize these objects? Because at the time of the so-called act between Tamar and Yehuda, he had left his signet ring and a few other possessions as collateral because he didn't have cash handy. Of course, Yehuda recognizes it because the Hakir Nar is also activated by Tamir. She says to Yehuda, do you recognize these? And he does. And that has been seen as one of the greatest verses in the whole of Torah, which emphasizes you should never embarrass somebody in public. Tamar did not do that. Although she was being put to death and being led to be killed, she still had that enormous emotional intelligence of not embarrassing Yehuda. That's the Hakir, is to recognize. And that is the heart of what mindfulness is. It's that ability to recognize, please. It's almost like we've been given this great gift when we were created, which is to say, don't get caught up in thinking and thinking and thinking and thinking about this and about that and coughing and quetching. Is just to recognize that you are alive and present in this moment. That's what mindfulness is. It's recognizing that this moment is absolutely unique. Think about it. There we go on the thinking. But think about it, and this is a good think, is that this moment right now has never been and will never be again. Listen to this. That moment I spoke to you about, think about, is already gone. And the moments to come, well, they still to come. So the only thing we have is what is present now. And that is a shift from doing to being. I've had over 40 years of a great brocha that I've been given, which is to study the brain and the mind. That's 40 and a half years now, and 30 as a psychiatrist. And stress has been the thread that has woven itself through all these 40 years. So I know, I think a little bit about this concept of suffering that so many people do suffer from, and that is stress. There's good stress, there's tolerable stress, and there's toxic stress. Just on my website, www.flip365.co.za. I just posted this morning a magnificent essay about Bruce McEwen. He is the world doyen on stress, the best in the world by far. And he talks about these three types of stress. That is good stress, like perhaps me giving this talk for an hour. I'm not interviewing anyone. I'm talking out of my head. I'm trying to structure it. I did a lot of preparation. I was a little bit nervous. But I think that when it's completed and it's maybe a few comments, it will become a podcast and send it around the world, then I've gained that challenge. I would have become a little bit more resilient. And I would have succeeded. That's good stress. Tolerable stress is, for example, losing a job or losing a loved one. But we do have the resources and the coping skills to eventually deal with that tolerable stress. It's a toxic stress, like severe unemployment and poverty and pogroms and holocausts and living on the street. Those toxic stress is where we have the effects on brain and body and we become ill. And the antidote, which Bruce McEwen says, and there's two actually. One is exercise, regular daily exercise, aerobic exercise. And you can get all your points for that if it belongs to certain medical aids. But the other one, and I was most surprised, but not really that surprised, is meditation. Especially mindfulness meditation. Listen to this. The World Authority, based on all his research and consensus amongst his colleagues, is saying that to keep healthy, because we're all going to have good stress and tolerable stress and maybe, God forbid, toxic stress. And how do we keep the brain healthy? One is exercise and the other one is meditation. And he's speaking specifically about mindfulness meditation. It's simple to do, but not that easy, because in Torah terms, we have what we call a Yetzer Hara. We have a Yetzer Tov, which is what we ought to do, and there's a Yetzer Hara, which is saying, oh, well, you don't really have to do it. No one's doing it, or do it because everyone's doing it. And we have this battle. If you become mindful and you practice and you become good at it, you'll recognize these two voices in your head, as it were, battling it out. Mindfulness is about recognizing, is about becoming aware, but not getting involved in those arguments. One of the wisest things, that when you become wise, you recognize there's many fights you don't get involved in. And one of them, you don't get involved in that. You watch it. Now, what's fascinating about mindfulness is that when you are being mindful, you become what we call a watcher or an observer of what's going on in your mind. We become aware, or at least in your conscious mind, you become a what? You smell, what you're smelling, what you're tasting, how the other person, the information you're getting from the other person, when they react or respond to something you said. You can tell a joke, and I'm known to tell jokes perhaps too many at times, and I have to be aware of how the receiver is taking the joke by watching their body behavior. You can only really do that if you switch on that awareness switch. And that's the basis of what they call emotional intelligence, the ability to recognize your own emotions, which comes from awareness, and mindfulness training, as well as recognizing or thinking about how that other person is thinking and certainly how they might be feeling. So here we have, just to sum up where we are, is we have now a technique that is on 24/7, or at least the potential to be switched on wherever you are. You could be at a queue at a shopping center waiting for the airplane to take off, or you've woken up at 2 o'clock in the morning and you've had 5 hours sleep, let's say, and what you're going to do. You get into gridlock in the traffic. There's no more porogon on a Friday morning. The kitkas are sold out. Pesach is coming in 3 hours. I mean, not for porogon and kitkas, but to get all the final chomets. Or you should have about 3 hours to get the chomets out or get the seder ready or whatever it might be. You can become aware of how you're thinking and feeling. And when you create that space between your thoughts and your emotions and your body system, then you can reconstruct how you think. Listen to that. Powerful. Extremely powerful. That when you get into a state of awareness and mindfulness, you can step back from the chaos of your mind, especially when it's stressed or got time pressure or being given bad news. Just step back and watch what's going on inside. Listen to this. Just step back, watch what's going on inside, and you'll notice something unbelievable. That you're not actually your thoughts or your emotions or your sensations. And that thoughts, emotions, and sensations and all other kinds of things come in, actually into the theater, on the stage of your life. They come in from the wings, they play their part, and they move on. Listen to this again. Thoughts are like clouds. They come in from the distance, they are there, and they move on. Think about it. If your thoughts continue to go round and round, is because you are feeding those thoughts or emotions. Think about this. Again, almost feel it. It's one of the most liberating ideas I've ever heard of, that you're not actually your thoughts. Your thoughts bubble up from your subconscious, where 99% of stuff is, and just like enter the stage from the wings. And if you're sitting in the audience, a spectator, you'll notice that they do their bit and they move on. And if you want to keep them there, of course you can. You can say encore, whatever they say, and that person continues. The same thing with your thoughts. Thoughts arise, they enter, and they disappear. Just like clouds do. Nothing's permanent. And if we go back into my clinical practice, and let's say I've got 10,000 narratives of patients, most of them depressed or anxious. Depression is really starts off to a large degree by ruminating, going over and over again what happened in the past. Of course, the genetic effects are more people more susceptible, and once that gets its hook, then it affects sleep and appetite and energy and interest and concentration and memory and a whole host of things. But most of the time, depression starts by rumination or being stuck in the past. Anxiety, which is also very common, is about the future. What if? What if? What if? What if? What if? Yeah, I understand, but remember, what if? What if? What if? You know, I like to tell the story on air. It's one of those family stories that in 1958, when I was born, I'm giving my age away, my parents moved into a house in Sachsenwald. We talk about state capture, talk about a suburb capture now, Sachsenwald. And there was a bathroom that was not en suite. And my parents decided to build a bathroom. Anyway, this was around about 1960, and the Sharpeville riots began, and everybody and their uncle and their aunt said, don't build, here starts the African Revolution. And remember, just 40, 50 years ago, we fled from Lithuania, and don't build. So the architect plans went into draw 13. Things get better. The market starts to boom. Out come those plans. And in 1969, just before they're about to build, the market crashes. And everybody, the auntie and the uncle, says, don't build. We remember the American Depression, what happened in the 1930s, and just hang on. In 1976, similar thing happened. They still want that bathroom suite. The Soweto rights begin. They say, this is really the revolution. Don't build. The same thing happens in 1983-84 when P.W. Vuti's famous Rubicon speech and the Rand tanks. And we say it's going to be devalued. And if you sell up a properties here, you'll have nothing if you have to immigrate. In 1990, Nelson Mandela was released. 1994, the first democratic elections. All I can say is that when my parents left in 2003, I was already married about 16 years, no children, is that that bathroom suite was never built. 45 years in the house, all this what if, what if, what if, and they could have enjoyed that bathroom if they had just been present and aware and said, we'll do it, and if we have to move, we'll have to move. We now take a short break, and we'll be back in a few moments.
The best part of your day. At the heart of your community. All the talk. All the music. All the news. Chai FM.
Welcome back. My name's Dr. Jonathan Mach. I'm standing in for Tony Ruma, Tikkun Olam. I'm speaking all about mindfulness practice. I've taken a thought experiment of meeting someone like Bill Gates in an elevator. I've got 60 seconds to convince him that mindfulness is a good thing for the world. Obviously, I'm expanding it now. Let's say I met a rabbi. I met a rabbi, and he said, what's this mindfulness thing? So I said, Rabbi, listen, I like to say to rabbis, listen, because they don't often listen, but some of them do. And this rabbi listens, and he's very interested in mindfulness, because he also noticed that when he davens three times a day, the Shmoneh Esrei, in the morning, Shachris, and the Mincha, in the afternoon, and the Maariv, in the evening, that his mind wanders. And I said, Rabbi, you're absolutely normal. You're a normal rabbi. You're a normal human being. Because the fact is that the science has shown, and this is remarkable, that it comes out of the University of Toronto, that we have a default mode network, a narrative network. So when your mind starts to wander, it wanders along certain networks, nerves, in the brain, and you're thinking about lunch coming up and what you had for breakfast, and that your mother hasn't phoned yet, and all a million things. Your mind goes off. That's the default. The default is for the mind to wander all over the show. What is more difficult is to pay attention. That's the mindfulness network. And that's what they call the experiential network, the experience of what is happening now. So the rabbi would say, okay, tell me more. Where in our Jewish life are we mindful? I said, Rabbi, how many times have you kept Shabbat? And he says, for the last 50 years. He says, what actually happens after Kiddush? Well, I make Kiddush, and I pour out a little bit of wine into some glasses, and whoever's at my table then sips it. And what happens between you finishing the Kiddush and them sipping? They keep quiet. They keep quiet. I say, that's being mindful. They're being mindful until that cup is drunk, they can't speak. So now the rabbi is really, really interested. He says, tell me more. So what happens after Kiddush? Oh, yeah, we chat a bit, and then someone says, time to vas. Usually my wife says, time to vas. What is vasing? So before we have the challah, we make the brochas over that, everybody goes and washes their hands. They go and put the water in the becher, and they pour it over their hands once, twice, three times, depending on their tradition. And then they say, Baruch atah, da-da-da-da, Netiyat Yadayim, and then they dry their hands, and then they can't speak. They can't speak. They're being mindful, because they know that until they eat the bread, they can't speak. And it's actually quite an interesting thing, this, especially when there's a large crowd, is to watch how people try to keep quiet. Most of them do. But then the household, they're going, Whether that is being quiet, I'm not quite sure, but it seems to be taken because someone's forgot the salt or the knife one of the chalas, whatever. And then the rabbi or whoever, the balabat, whoever does it, picks up the two chalas and says, Baruch atah, amotzi lechem min ha'aretz. And then he cuts and he eats. And the people at the table have to be mindful, paying attention, that until they eat that piece of bread, they can't speak. They can't speak. One is being mindful. One is recognizing the fact that the halacha, the rule is that you can't eat the bread until the brocha, and you can't make the brocha until you fast. And then when you eat the bread, only then can you eat. Wow. That is amazing. So we have mindfulness all around us. It's natural, but it's difficult to do because we have this network that's been found now that is natural to drift away. And that can be useful. I think Einstein found his theory of relativity through that network, if I can put my understanding together. But unfortunately, what happens is that we now have social media. And I have family who's involved in teaching children and adolescents, and he says the teachers now who have been teaching for 47, they've never had so much lack of interest, ability to pay attention because of that phone. That phone keeps going. There's the Facebook, there's the Twitter, there's the this and that. And that has become the major distractor of our age. I'm not quite sure how this is going to pan out when they become adults, but I think there's going to be consequences that we did not think of. And one of the most important is the ability to be mindful in the presence of others. And relationships, deep relationships, strong relationships, is what stabilizes us against tolerable and toxic stress. And the way we build up relationships is by listening, by paying full attention. I'll repeat that. That if you want to build up a relationship with somebody else, you have to pay full attention. If your cell phone goes, that relationship, that communication is broken. In my practice, whether it's groups, and I'll be soon moving to Glen Hazel, we'll be restarting my groups, no one can use a cell phone. One of the reasons being that it breaks the concentration, the attention. Baruch Hashem, for us that keep Shabbos, the greatest gift is that we can't switch on any of this stuff from the time that Shabbos comes in until it goes out. So we have built in into the Torah way of living times that we can use it and times that we can't. We're going to have a short ad break, and then I want to speak a little bit about the scientific findings that support mindfulness and why Bill Gates and the rabbis should incorporate it as a worldwide phenomenon. 101.9 High FM. Welcome back to Tikkun Olam. I'm standing in for Tony Ruma. My name's Dr. Jonathan Moch. I want to just talk for a few moments about the science, because let's say Bill Gates called me and he says, oh, that's interesting, but give me 5 minutes of what is the scientific background to this. And I'm going to introduce a couple of words that you might not be familiar with, but if you go to my site, flip365.co.za, There's a lot of categories that could explain it. So the first one is neuroplasticity. Neuroplasticity, neuroplasticity, is the fantastic finding of the last 30 years that the brain keeps changing. It's not old at 25. It can keep changing, and you can use it unless there's a severe Alzheimer's. You can use it. You can be doing all kinds of things. I know a friend of mine, he's over 80, and he says what he's doing in his life, he's using his left hand now rather than his right hand So he's writing with his left hand, he's brushing his teeth with his left hand, and whatever. That's neuroplasticity. The next exciting thing is epigenetics. Yep, epi, above, genetics. And this is just mind-blowing, that our lifestyle, our stress levels, what we eat, how we meditate, how much we exercise, can affect, listen to this, the expression of genes by switching on or switching them off. How's that? Lifestyle. Today we're talking about mindfulness. Can switch on and switch off certain genes for immune systems, for blood pressure, for sugar control, and whatever. Stay in tune for that one. Number three, longevity. Most people are living long time. They get into 65, which 40, 50 years was old, and that was retirement age. But most people can live to 90. What are they going to do for 25 years after retirement? What are they going to do when the dog is dead and there's great-grandchildren with their lives? Are they going to just sit around and do nothing? So there's lots of opportunities there. And the fourth one is neurogenesis. Neuro, nerves again, genesis, new ones. Fabulous finding that in certain parts of the brain, in the smell centers and the hippocampus, which is involved in memory and learning, new cells are formed every day, no matter how old are you. But if you don't use them, you lose them. Can you see why I'm so excited about mindfulness? You can switch it on whenever you want. It doesn't cost you a cent. You can just focus on your breath or your body or different senses. And there's lots of apps and there's lots of ways to do this. And you can keep your brain fit and healthy and keep great relationships. So if we look at four structures in the brain, and these are really tough words, but I'm just going to introduce them quickly. We have one called the prefrontal cortex. That's just behind your eyes. That's involved in what they call executive function and decision-making. And if you know people who have had injuries to the frontal lobe, they have poor decision-making, poor executive function. It often goes in dementia. And that, the gray matter in that area, is definitely thickened in people who practice mindfulness every day in different ways. Another area is the hippocampus. I mentioned it briefly. That's involved in learning and memory. That is really, really affected in Alzheimer's and other memory disorders. Once again, those who meditate shown that it gets thicker. A third area is the anterior cingulate cortex. Wow, what a term. Anterior in the front, cingulate cortex just behind the frontal lobe. And that's involved in attention, the ability to pay attention, the ability to be and recognize what is happening in your interaction right now. That gets thicker. Then finally, there's a fourth one called the amygdala, which is involved in the fight or flight. And this is what makes us anxious. And people that practice mindfulness meditation have found that the actual volume, the cell volume of the amygdala, goes down. So we have four areas in the brain, clear cut now, by science, proven that people that practice actually change their brain. They change the thickness or the size or whatever. So I would like to thank you and Bill Gates and the Chief Rabbi for listening. I hope I've made my case quite clear that mindfulness is now not on the edge, on the periphery. It's not for hippies or you've got no time for it. If you just watch your breath one cycle, your in-breath and your out-breath, if you on Shabbos can keep quiet between washing your hands and hamotzi, you're being mindful. If you've been listening to this show and you've got parts of it, you have been mindful. All I ask for you is to learn about it, get into practice where you can maximize it, and I can guarantee you that your life will be different. Thank you for listening.